the Civic Media Radio Network, moving Wisconsin forward one joke at a time. This is As Goes Wisconsin with Kristen Broad.
And so it goes, and so it goes, and so it goes, and so it goes. But where it's going, no one knows. Hello, Wisconsin!
Now, filling in for the new mom, here's Jane Matinere.
Good morning and welcome to As Goes Wisconsin on this Tuesday, November 7th. Greg Buck is with me in studio. Calvin is on the board, and I am delighted we are being joined by our friend and colleague and a person of so many accomplishments. I could spend 20 minutes just going through the list of everything she's done. But Maggie Dawn is here as well. All kinds of things coming up on the show today at 10:33. Dan Schaefer will be here. We will recombobulate. Coming up at 11:06, Dr. Stephen Cole from Marquette University is going to join us, and we're going to talk about the GDP. It's very sexy.
I can't wait.
I'm very excited. And when I emailed him, I told him I need him to explain the GDP to me like I'm in fifth grade. So we'll see how that goes. We're going to start off, though, with something that's really important that's happening in the Supreme Court today. Supreme Court is hearing a case on whether or not people who are under a domestic violence restraining order should be allowed to have guns. So, Maggie Dawn, this seems bad. Oh, and now she's frozen. Oh, there you are. Now we can't hear you. We cannot hear you.
Can't hear you, Maggie.
All right. We'll see what's going on with the live stream. Otherwise, Maggie, just give us a call at 844-967-2789, 844-967-2789, because we are unable to hear you right now. So here's what's going on. Zaki Rahimi had been subject to a domestic violence restraining order in 2019, after threatening to shoot his girlfriend after assaulting her. After a Texas court entered a domestic violence restraining order against him, he was a suspect in multiple shootings, and police then found firearms in his apartment. He pleaded guilty to violating the ban on firearms for those who are subject to a domestic violence restraining order and was sentenced to prison. And now the Supreme Court is taking this up today. And I just have a really bad feeling about this. Maggie, are you with us now?
I am, Jane. Sorry about that. Love to start off a morning with a little bit of audio difficulty.
This is a big case, and it's going to have massive implications, right?
It's, I don't want to overstate, but this is really all of the marbles, and it's because of the case that the Rahimi case is asking the Supreme Court to interpret. And that is a 2022 case, obviously decided by this newly constituted, highly right-leaning Supreme Court called the Bruin case. And the Bruin case set out a standard that any firearm regulation in the country must now meet or be found unconstitutional. And what's really worrisome about this is that Bruin standard is also the exact same test, slightly different wording, but that you now see in the abortion decision, Dobbs, the year before. And it's establishing effectively what is a historical precedent test for regulations or the acknowledgement of rights, as was the case in the Dobbs decision. And what that historical precedent test says is you have to point to some kind of 18th century analogy to this regulation in when we're talking about firearm regulation, or this right when you're talking about privacy and healthcare access rights. And of course, by doing so, you're trying to take modern questions and answer them under the cultural understandings of the 18th century. Now, I know Speaker Mike Johnson might like that. But boy, if you're a woman, a black person, person of color, LGBTQIA+, a Muslim, a Jew, or anybody else that wasn't a land-owning white man in the 18th century, that may sound problematic to you. And it ends up in absurd results like this could be. What reasonable person, right, no matter what your politics, would say the government shouldn't be able to prevent domestic abusers from possessing firearms?
Because they weren't allowed to do that in the 1700s. It's absurd, Maggie.
Totally absurd.
They want to refer back to a period of time where women were considered property.
Exactly. And the statistics here are really frightening, right? Because the reason that I make reference to the Dobbs decision isn't in isolation. It's the same bogus, well, we have to find a historical precedent for it. Well, of course there wasn't a right to abortion in the 18th century because women and black folks were still chattel, right? But here's what we know from the data. When a woman becomes pregnant, the odds of her suffering from domestic abuse go up extraordinarily. 20% of pregnant women experience intimate partner violence.
20%.
Yes, ma'am. And if you are an adolescent or the pregnancy was unintended, the odds are even higher, which means when you combine this dual threat of we can't regulate guns and you don't have a right to choose your own health care, that spells violent death for women. And while that may be the tip of the spear, all of us end up suffering, which is that piece, you know, those articles that John Dietrich so eloquently put forward in the Journal Sentinel about the explosion of firearm suicides in the state of Wisconsin.
Yes. If you're just joining us, Maggie Dawn is our guest. You can catch Maggie every Monday through Thursday across the Civic Media Network from 6 to 7 p.m. We are talking about what's happening today in the Supreme Court in a case that is being considered on whether or not people who are under a domestic violence restraining order should be allowed to get guns. I saw this, Maggie, in the American Journal of Public Health. An abused woman is 5 times more likely to be killed by a male partner when there is a firearm in the house. I mean, the numbers just don't lie. And I have a really bad feeling that once again, our Supreme Court is going to act to protect the guns and not the lives.
Yeah, this is, again, to me, where all of this springs from is this ridiculous standard that the Supreme Court has adopted, which is this retrograde 18th century must find an analogous right or regulation from then in order for our modern society, more diverse than it's ever been, more secular than it's ever been, to somehow fit what our needs now from a legal perspective into what society, culture, and our democracy's needs were then. That doesn't pass even the smell test, and the results are terrible. This is an example, but let's just step back from the legal technicalities for a minute. If we take the idea that, well, it has to be this 18th century historical understanding or historical analogy, you end up with what I'm going to call triple-layered bias. Here's the triple layers. Well, first of all, who got to write down the history and make the laws back then?
Oh, wait, don't tell me. So, I assume it was landowning white men.
Yes, yes, yes. Okay, so there's bias one, which is who's writing down the history. Of course, there was the underlying second level of bias, which is women, people of color, anybody who wasn't a landowning white man, didn't get to vote at all back then. So there's that layer of bias, right? So it's who's writing the history down, generally the political winners, how history gets recorded. That's all about that. Who's voting? It wasn't us and black folks back then. And then the third layer of bias that enters is that judges are then purporting to be academic historians and purport to have the good sensibility to parse which historical facts are analogous or not analogous. And what's really scary in this Rahimi case is that the appeals court, which was the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals, an all-white appeals court, one of the most Trumpiest of all appeals court, I'm going to be talking about this tomorrow on my show at 6 p.m., that appeals court basically discounted all of the historical analogies that the government presented to defend this law. And that is that third layer of bias, which is the bias of individual judges to decide which history matters now. When you layer those three layers of bias together, the cumulative effect is not one that protects and honors the humanity of historically disadvantaged groups of people, because of course not, because judges to this day remain more white, more male, and older and richer than the rest of us. So this is a really broken way for us to evaluate federal regulations, as well as the rights that the federal government will acknowledge or different groups of people. There has to be a better way, regardless of our party.
Yeah, this does not bode well. And I go back to thinking about when they overturned Dobbs, when the Supreme Court overturned Dobbs, and Alito's opinion basically referred back to, what was it, a 14th century Englishman who believed in witches? That's what he used for his argument to overturn Dobbs.
They're not critical academicians of history, right? Like, that's not what a judge's expertise is. And so now you have them, and judges, we all suffer from various cognitive biases. And when judges are now deciding which history matters with whatever lens they're bringing to their analysis or their sort of leanings prior to a case, these are human beings. They're judges. They have values and beliefs. And those impact which histories they're more likely to credit, all else being equal. And we see that. What an absurdism to have a Supreme Court judge, when deciding the privacy rights of women, to refer as authority to a man who believed in witches.
We will continue this conversation when we come back. If you want to check in, call and or text 844-967-2789. Please join us and stick around. You're listening to As Goes Wisconsin. This is the Civic Media Radio Network. Welcome to As Goes Wisconsin. Jane Matinere in for Kristen Bry. Greg Bach with me in studio. Calvin is on the board, and our colleague and friend Maggie Dawn from the Maggie Dawn Show is joining us on the phone. We're going to get back to Maggie in just a second. Dave from Waukesha has been holding on the line. Good morning, Dave. What did you want to say about this Supreme Court case that they're considering today?
I can't even believe we're having this conversation. It's simply a no-brainer. Somebody who has a history of violence should not have a lethal weapon in their hand, and they must have a history of violence or they wouldn't have the restraining order. That's
right.
Number one. And number two, I'm going to go out on a limb here and say that our founding fathers gave us the right to bear arms because there were no grocery stores. We had to shoot animals to live, and we had no national defense, no army. That's why they gave us the right to bear arms. Any person that's honest with himself will admit that. And that's what I got to say about that.
Appreciate that, Dave. Thank you so much. 844-967-2789, 844-967-2789. Greg had a question for Maggie.
Hey, Maggie, I had a question. I was wondering if, you know, when we see cases like this come about, are we seeing any outside forces, be it like the NRA, saying we need to protect rights of ownership for all, or are they holding back maybe on this one particularly?
I haven't reviewed the NRA's amicus brief in this case. I did read a Wall Street Journal op-ed on this yesterday. And listen, Mr. Rahimi is about the most unattractive possible person for the NRA to defend their right to have a weapon, right? The guy, after the restraining order, there was additional acts of violence after he was criminally charged under this particular statute, went out and shot his gun in five more incidents. I mean, the guy was a menace. Nobody disputes that. So the tact that you see taken in the Wall Street Journal and other similar leaning publications or more conservative leaning viewpoints is, listen, this isn't like, of course, this guy shouldn't have a gun. But you can't take away the gun or prevent him from having a gun based on a civil restraining order. So it's a due process argument. They're saying there's not enough process and protection there.
So basically, well, they'll find any reason to say, do not take the gun away.
Yeah. In other words, because there isn't a criminal process with the standards, the high burdens of proof in order to issue a restraining order, we have to preference the right of the gun owner, which to me, again, let's talk about what's actually happening here. The legal standards are interesting. And of course, that's the argument that they have to make to defend the right of someone like Mr. Rahimi to continue to possess basically an arsenal of firearms. But understand what's actually happening in that moment and what is really operating under that argument. And that is the right of the gun owner trumps and surpasses the woman's right and by extension society's right to exist in safety.
Yes.
Yep.
So, right, when we start to put these things together, what we always have at the root of these really difficult arguments are two values, two good things, arguably, coming together, which is, yes, our Constitution does protect the right to bear arms. We also have an inalienable right to life and the pursuit of happiness. This is enshrined as well. So how do we balance when those two rights, those two values are in conflict? And the preferencing almost without question, the right to bear arms by this Supreme Court and conservative-leaning appeals courts, to me, doesn't pass the societal smell test. Today.
I completely agree with you, Maggie, but I feel very, very confident that the court is going to side with the gun because that just seems to be where this is all heading. And I want to remind everybody as well, even if you're not a woman or a person of color or a marginalized group, this affects all of us. The executive director of Moms Demand Action, Angela Farrell Zabala, notes that many mass gunmen end up killing their current or former intimate partner as part of their killing spree. A lot of these guys who have committed these crimes have histories of domestic violence.
Yeah, it's a harbinger. It is itself a red flag, if you will. And we now know as we're looking and people are dissecting what the mass shooting that occurred in Maine 2 weeks ago, we're getting to a place where we understand that like red flag laws, even when you have them, don't work. And so there needs to be a difficult confrontation with these presumptions of rights and this presumption of which rights trump other rights, because our collective wellness, our collective safety, based on the safety and dignity of each individual person, is now at risk. And this isn't something that's an urban problem. It's not a gender problem. It's not a sexual identity or sexual preference problem. It's a shared problem.
That's one thing that Dietrich's article did say.
Yes.
Is that the gun problem is it's urban, it's suburban, it's rural, it's everything. It's everywhere.
844-967-2789. 844-967-2789 if you want to call and or text. Lynn Bauer is watching on the stream this morning, and Lynn says, so the case outcome will basically create a year-round open season on women, family values, my butt. Jack from Merrimack texting in, it's amazing to me, SCOTUS continues to ignore two parts of the Second Amendment, militia, which none of the individuals involved seem to be a part of, and more importantly, well-regulated, as it seems SCOTUS just throws out virtually all regulations.
It is a troubling, again, the preferencing of words when you read legal documents. Oh, these ones mean a lot. These other ones, well, we'll just ignore that. All of these are opportunities for judges and justices to reinvigorate or reassess some of the way that these analyses have been done in the past, and to at least acknowledge the modern problems in which their rulings operate. The thing that I hear most frequently from people when they complain about the justice system, the legal system, lawyers and judges, is they're so removed from reality. Well, each of these cases is an opportunity for the Supreme Court to re-engage with reality. My belief, Jane, is the same as yours. I don't think we can expect a good outcome here, given what has already come from this court in 2022 on this very issue.
Well, and Maggie,
but what I think we...
Go ahead, sorry.
Yeah, go ahead. What I think we're seeing is that regular folks are now responding to this and saying the things that callers and texters are saying, which is, that doesn't make any real world sense. And when that starts to happen, it will have electoral consequences, one hopes.
Well, I just think I they're not going to be happy until we go back to the happy days of witch burnings. Back when times were good, man.
Oh, you're in trouble then. You are in trouble.
I'm serious. There, we are going backwards.
Yeah.
Especially when it comes to women and children, it's highly, highly disturbing.
Well, me, Jane, Catherine, all the nasty women, we're all going to be burned at the stake, Jane. That's what's up next.
Well, at least we'll be together in the afterlife. I'd rather hang out there with you. Maggie Dawn has been our guest. Thank you so very much for taking time out for us, Maggie. Really, really appreciate it. And stay with us when we come back. Dan Schaefer will be here so we can recombobulate. I understand there was a little news about the Brewers.
I swear to God, Jane,
yesterday.
This is not the time to joke.
We will kick that around coming up. You're listening to As Goes Wisconsin on the Civic Media Radio Network.
If you leave me now, you'll take away the biggest part of me.
Welcome back to As Goes Wisconsin. Jane Matinere in for Kristen Bry. Greg Bach with me in studio. Calvin, good choice on the tunes there on the board. And Dan Schaefer is joining us from the recombobulation area. Good morning, Dan. How you doing?
Good morning, Jane. Doing well. I was a little discombobulated, but I didn't hear my typical theme song. But once I saw Greg belting out the tunes over there for that for that one, it came together for me.
It's completely appropriate now that we know that Brewers manager Craig Counsell is going to the Cubs. Nobody saw that coming, right?
No. Kristen sent me a text message on my drive home yesterday. I told Pat Kreitlow this morning. This is real. Send me. She goes. Oh my gosh, Counsell news. I'm like, all right. He went to New York. I don't text and drive. So I got home, sat on the couch, pulled up my phone, typed in Craig Counsell, and said Craig Counsell going to the Cubs, and I dropped my phone.
Did you really?
I'm so hurt. I'm so hurt.
Well, and we were just talking about this yesterday, or yeah. Right?
We've been talking about it like almost every day for the past like week, just kind of bringing up, he's talking to them, he's talking to those, and whatever, he'll go to the Mets probably, or he'll stay here.
And I think when we were talking about this yesterday, I said too, I think there would have been a lot of goodwill had he gone to the Mets. I don't think people would have had a problem with that, like they do with this decision to move down south.
Yeah. I mean, I have my thoughts. Dan, what are you about you?
It's not great, is it? I mean, it doesn't
feel good.
No. Like you were saying, I wouldn't have been totally surprised if he had left. If it had been, you know, the David Stearns connection in New York seemed like they were kind of laying the breadcrumbs for that for like a year.
Yeah.
Right. Knowing that Counsell's contract was up, knowing that he wasn't going to sign an extension before the season, knowing the Stearns connection, the Mets had a bad season. So it just seemed like it was all lining up for him to go to New York. But I guess the pull of the Wrigley in Chicago was just too much. There was a really interesting piece at Sports Illustrated from Tom Verducci talking about how this kind of brought together a couple different things the council was looking for, and saying that he wanted to like reset the market for manager salaries.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, obviously getting $8 million a year from the Cubs, you know, if the Brewers would have given him $5.5 million a year, which was what the Journal Sentinel reported that they offered, that would have been, I think, the highest annual salary for managers in Major League Baseball. So the Cubs really like blew him away with that offer. But I think also, like it said, you know, in the piece, it was talking about how Council also wanted to stay in the Midwest because he has two kids who play college baseball at Michigan and Minnesota.
Mm-hmm.
He has another kid who's still in high school. So I think there was, you know, and I think he, you know, he's talked about Wrigley and Chicago and baseball in the past and in favorable terms. So I think it was just kind of all lined up, but man, what a, you know, feels like one of those betrayal almost type of moments. And I don't know if you saw the stories this morning, the Whitefish Bay Park, named after Council, was vandalized last night.
His hometown
of Whitefish Bay was vandalized.
Some salty language.
Yeah, that's right.
Don't do that, people.
Don't do that.
Don't do that.
But, so, you know, it was a real Whitefish bait and switch.
Ooh, see, he had to do the joke. I saw it. I saw it on the social media. He had to.
I tweeted it and I was like, oh, I'm gonna annoy Greg with that tomorrow on Askos.
I think I clicked on it too. But the question I have for you is, did he even give Milwaukee a chance to counter the offer? Because according to Antanasio, he got the call from Council and said, I'm leaving. And his first words were, are you kidding me right now?
Yeah.
So that means that Milwaukee didn't even get the chance to counter. Now, I don't think they would have. I don't think they were going to offer him $6 or $7 million a year. I don't think they were in the interest of doing that. They're not in the interest of spending money. So it just, I don't know. Like, I'm hurt and betrayed by him. I'm very angry at Mark Antanasio because I think this is the culmination of years of trying to play cheap baseball with one of the best managers in the league. And this is what happens.
844-967-2789, 844-96-PARTY. If you want to call in and or text talking about Craig Council's decision to head to the Cubs after managing the Brewers. Good morning, everyone. John from the Falls checking in. Yesterday, I was feeling like Craig Council betrayed us, but upon further reflection, I no longer blame him for leaving. I think it's ironic and disgusting that we have an owner who says that Craig turned his back on our team and our community when the owner himself has decided to use the profits made off the backs of Brewers fans to invest in soccer teams and pad his own bank account rather than paying for talent to make the team better. It takes a lot of nerve to ask for upgrades to a stadium when the best team you're willing to build is filled with AA hitters and Major League Baseball has-beens. It makes me sad to say that until we have a new owner, the Brewers are dead to me. I won't buy any of their merch, tickets for any games, pay for TV access to watch them, or support them in any way. It also seems like he's trying to ram the stadium renovation through as quickly as possible while he dumps salary everywhere he can.
Was this a text or an email?
John, this is our friend John from the Falls.
Is this a recombobulation area column?
Whoa.
You know?
There's a certain amount of truth to that. Mark Antanasio got on the podium yesterday and was like, you know, I think he said something effective. He lost us and lost our community. Dude, you don't live here. Craig Council lived here. He had investments in this area. He loved this area. Mark Antanasio doesn't get to play the victim now. Like, oh, he doesn't believe in the community. Dude, you don't. You live in Los Angeles and Brooklyn. That's where you live. You don't really live here. You come here every once in a while. You show your face. I got no love and no, like, sympathy for that man.
And I think that's where the unhappiness of the fans is going to be directed. I think it's going to be all directed at Mark Antanasio.
I think it's so interesting. You mentioned that comment from Antanasio about losing the community. The reporting from Kurt Hogg at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, the sentence before that in Antanasio's comments, he mentions the stadium financing plan. To put those right next to each other It's just, it's really something to see Atanasio mention the stadium financing plan alongside the council comments and alongside losing the community. That is, I don't know. That's, I don't even know what to make of it.
He's beyond, he's a millionaire tone deaf dude who's just like, whatever. Like, I mean, John from the Falls is not wrong. This guy has no, it's about what, like all my toys. He doesn't care about his toys. He just wants to get his toys.
844-967-2789, 844-96-PARTY. Rico from Rock County is joining us. Good morning, Rico.
Hey, how you guys doing today?
We're good, thank you. What do you think about Mr. Council heading south?
This whole thing to me, guys, I just want to say quickly, it's so reminiscent of the Brett Favre thing. But I do want to say, you know, we know Favre went and ghosted that season over there in the Jets and then ended up playing for the Vikings, and he even wanted to go there. And I thought to myself, but you know what? I'm going to give Brett a little credit here. There is no way did he ever talk about, I don't think he would have even entertained going to the Chicago Bears.
No, no, he wanted to be, he wanted to be a Viking. That's true. You're very right. He wanted to be a Viking. The Jets were a stepping stone for him.
So do you feel,
imagine him of wanting to go into the Bears?
No.
Do you feel like Craig Council betrayed the fans?
I don't know if I want to call it betrayal. Sports is such a money game, and we all knew he was leaving. That's a little kick in the pants. Wisconsin people are not going to let you forget that. We might have forgave Brett, but it took a while. That's all I'm going to say.
Thank you so much, Rico. Really appreciate it. Have a great day. 844-967-2789, 844-96-PARTY. If you want to call and or text on Craig Council's decision to go to the Chicago Cubs and also Mark Atanasio's decision to let him go. Dan, how do you think this is going to affect the franchise going forward?
It's so interesting that this is happening right in the middle of the stadium deal negotiations, right? Like, I don't think this is, you know, necessarily going to impact the bigger picture. We're talking about, you know, a 27-year lease for the Brewers. I don't think Craig Council would be around for coaching the Brewers in 2050. So there's bigger forces at play here than that. I do think it's the PR of it. It certainly isn't great. Like, when you could, you're asking for more than $500 million in public funding from state and local taxpayers, and you get outbid by the Cubs by $2.5 million a year. That doesn't seem great. That doesn't seem great. I think it might, you know, give legislators pause and say, if they were on the fence and say, hold on, what's going on here? This franchise, we're about to shell out $400 million state funding, you know, $60 million county funding, $60 million city funding for this deal. Is that really what we want to be doing right now? You know, but I don't know if it's really going to play into those calculations as much as just maybe giving people some pause.
We have Jeff on the line from Milwaukee. Jeff, thanks for listening. What do you want to say about Craig Council's decision to head to the Cubs?
Well, good morning, everybody. So I would personally put 75% of the blame on Mark Atanasio. I mean, he has cheaped out. We've all talked about that. But I'm going to talk about one aspect that I haven't seen reported anywhere, and it's about Craig Council's ethics on this decision, because he altruistically pointed out that, you know, through his agent, oh, we're going to try to reset the market on managerial salaries. I'm trying to do this for my fraternity of managers, that kind of thing. And he literally took a dump on the Cubs manager, David Ross, who was employed by the Cubs as their current manager. And he had to have negotiated and settled on a salary and his contract while David Ross was still their manager. I mean, if you think about the sequence of events, right? And then once Council was signed, then the Cubs called David Ross, wherever he is in the offseason, and say, oh, by the way, you're no longer employed with us. So there's a little bit of a Craig Council ethical dilemma as I look at it.
That's a really interesting point, Jeff. It is. I mean, as you said, obviously there were negotiations going on that no one knew about. And the other thing I was hearing on some of the sports talkers, it's pretty remarkable that this never leaked. There was no hint of this at all.
I mean, he was just his free agency just started like last week. He was granted permission to talk to Cleveland and New York and, because he was still under contract, but his free agency came up last week. So after that, I mean, who knows? I mean, for all we know, the Ricketts may have just called him up on 2 days ago and said, hey, there you go.
Well, that was in the Sports Illustrated piece that I referenced. The Sports Illustrated reported that Council became a free agent on November 1st, the day after his contract expired, and the Cubs called on November 1st, saying their interest was to bring him in, calling him one of the one or two best managers in the game.
Yeah. I mean, his ethics, I don't know. It's the game. If every manager had to worry about another manager's job, then they would never... This would be like the old days of the reserve clause where they would have to be let go by the owners. It's like, I get what the caller is saying, but I also don't challenge his ethics. It's just, this is business. It's about money. These guys cycle around. He'll be fine. They'll make their money. They'll coach somewhere else and maybe it'll be a better fit.
Well, and I think I can compare this to radio because on air spots, there are only so many. Just like general managers for baseball teams, there are only so many. And I have lost my job and been replaced by a friend that I knew.
Mm-hmm.
It's not fun and it doesn't feel good, but it happens. All right, when we come back, it is 1 year away from today. We will be going to the polls. Oh. We're going to talk elections. Stay with us. You're listening to As Goes Wisconsin. Dan Schaefer is here. Greg Buck and Kelvin is on the board. You can always check in too at 844-967-2789. You're listening to the Civic Media Radio Network. Welcome to As Goes Wisconsin, 10 minutes before 11 o'clock. Jane Matner in for Kristen Bry, Greg Bach with me in studio, Kelvin on the board, and Dan Schaefer joining us as we recombobulate every Tuesday from 10:30 to 11. Just a reminder, tomorrow at 10:30, Kristen Bry will be joining us, and hopefully we'll get a little look at Frankie Lou and see how she's doing.
I think this will be the third week we haven't seen her.
The baby, I know.
And with every time you say it, you're like, maybe this time we will see the baby.
It's got to work. It's got to work for mom.
Show me the baby.
Show me the baby.
Show me the baby.
I pester her a couple of times a week to send me pictures. So
I never pester her because that's your job.
And I'm doing a good job.
You're
of
doing
it.
A great job.
Anyway, coming up in the next hour at 11:06, it's going to be very exciting. And I'm really genuinely excited
me
about
too.
This.
I really am.
Dr. Stephen Cole from Marquette University is going to join us to talk about the GDP, the gross domestic product, and what that means and why it's important and why we should care. And when I emailed him, I said, I need you to explain it to me like I'm a fifth grader. So hopefully he's going to break it down nice and digestibly.
With crayons.
With crayons and picture books.
Yeah.
Possibly. All right. 1 week, 1 week, 1 year from today, we will be going to the polls and casting ballots. How are you feeling about things, Dan Schaefer?
Feeling pretty good.
Are you?
You know, we're about to enter the pressure cooker of Wisconsin being one of the five or six states that is going to decide the presidential election. High stakes, of course. But I think, you know, the Democrats in Wisconsin are, you know, did kind of a 1 year out thing over the weekend where they started their canvassing and Ben Wickler was crisscrossing the state and they had different events all over to start start that ground game, start knocking on doors, start figuring things out. So I think that's, you know, a really important part of the process that's going to unfold. But yeah, I think just, you know, we also saw some polling over the weekend with Joe Biden, maybe not quite where you'd want him to be in some of these key swing states, but also at the same time, it's like, normally at this part of the cycle, we're talking about the primary. We're not talking about the general election yet. I think we're those polls putting Trump against Biden are skipping over a few steps that might be happening over these next couple months, because is it a foregone conclusion that Trump is going to be the nominee, is going to be the person giving that nomination speech at the RNC in Milwaukee next July?
I'm watching Nikki Haley. I just find it interesting because Nikki is doing, what, isn't she tied with DeSantis now? Or even coming in higher than DeSantis?
Essentially about the same. I think she's ahead of him in New Hampshire, but I think in the national polls she's more or less pulled even. She's really been the only candidate with any positive momentum in that GOP primary race. The problem with that is that primary is that positive momentum has brought her from about, like, I don't know, like 5% to 13% or something like that. It's not exactly like she's, you know, blowing the doors off and making this, at, you know, stratospheric rise. She's, you know, just more or less doing better than Ron DeSantis, who has run one of the worst presidential campaigns I have ever seen. He was at like 30% before he announced, and it was only like 10% behind Trump. He was heralded as this candidate who was going to be, you know, the next evolution of the not Trump, you know, but still very Trumpy part of the Republican Party. And he has just absolutely fallen flat. And he's just run such a horrible campaign. You know, about a month ago, he said he was going all in on Iowa. And about a couple weeks later, the Des Moines Register's gold standard Iowa poll had him losing ground in Iowa. So yeah. It's just like every time. You know, he's just gone down, down, down throughout this primary. So it just seems like it's just setting up for Trump to run away with it. And I think that's why we're seeing some of the polling now with the head to head. It's just like the general election hasn't started yet, but they're acting like it is because there's been so little interest in the Republican primary, because mainly I think because DeSantis has done so horribly, but also because of the rest of the candidates outside of Nikki Haley haven't really done anything either.
Honestly, if I'm Ben Wickler, I'm kind of happy about the polls that came out, because it means you can push more for dollars, get people to work harder. If Biden's ahead by 10 points, then people are like, oh, it's a foregone conclusion, I'll stay home, or I'll do this. If he's losing in the polls, that means people are going to get off their tuchuses and really work harder and get people out there voting. But the question, and this is really speculative because it has to do with Wisconsin and Scott Walker running for president in 2012. Do you think that this, spectacular flame out on Ron DeSantis will hurt his future as governor of Florida?
I'm wondering about that too, because people, I mean, there's lots of stuff going on in Florida there are many things that are not good.
Yeah. I mean, even being primaried by a Republican who's just like, I'm not this dude.
You have to wonder, I feel like his whole reelection that he was running, and he won a resounding reelection victory in Florida, running against a bad candidate in Charlie Crist. But yeah. I think it certainly warps his future as a player on the national stage, because he had a absolutely golden opportunity to take the reins of the Republican primary. And he's just run one of the worst campaigns I've ever seen.
And it says a lot about the Republican Party that they didn't, as a group, come together and say, we need to shake off the dust of Cheetos and we need to anoint a new king. And the fact that they didn't do it and, in fact, went essentially back to their ex and said, no, he's the guy. It speaks a lot about the party. It speaks a lot about DeSantis. It's, once again, we're in a presidential election where the GOP just cannot stop shooting themselves in the feet.
Well, and I have to say, too, I am amazed for a political candidate who has so little charisma and is so socially awkward. I have never seen anything like Ron DeSantis trying to act like a normal human being. It was unbelievable. it was.
That smile at the debate.
He just was so uncomfortable. And so I'm amazed that he has achieved the success that he has.
Yeah, I think it's more likely that he drops out before Iowa than he wins Iowa.
Oh, yeah.
Interesting.
It says a lot when you're the most charming man in Florida.
Dan Schaefer, it's always a pleasure having you here. Thank you so much for joining us. We will talk to you again soon. Stay with us when we come back. Dr. Stephen Cole from Marquette University is going to be with us. You're listening to As Goes Wisconsin. This is the Civic Media Radio Network.
Wheels up and we'll be rocking. Getting out. I need you to recombobulate me. I want you to recombobulate me. I need you to recombobulate me. Won't somebody recombobulate me?
Broadcasting to Waukesha at 101.1 FM.
Broadcasting to Southeast Wisconsin at 540 AM.
This is The Shaw, WAUK. This is your hometown radio, refreshed, keeping you informed, entertained, and connected locally across the Civic Media Network.